Good morning. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Today's Tuesday, March 29, 2005. It's now 10:40, and we have with us the entire committee. Everyone is here this morning, all back from what I hope was a wonderful Easter weekend. We're going to look at Senate Bill 67 this morning. We've closed public testimony on 67. Asked members if they had any proposed amendments to the bill that we would consider those today. Have Mr. Haugen here with us from Alaska Physicians and Surgeons to answer any questions that you may have. So we open it for discussion. Any amendments from the members? Discussion? Senator Guess.
Question, Mr. Seekins. What do we know that in statute there is a definition of health care providers? It says this act applies to suits against health care providers and to malpractice claims, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't refer to a definition in statute somewhere. Do we know that we have? It was a question I had, and we got into public testimony and forgot to bring it up.
I don't recall.
Might just be something we want to.
Mr. Haugen, do you remember? Is there a definition?
I think it's a statutory definition, but I don't recall the section.
We can certainly take a brief moment and try to find out. You want to try to find out? Let's just recess for a couple of minutes. What definition, or is there someone we have forgotten?
Pretty inclusive.
So our intent here is to cover doctors, nurses, nurse practitioners, PAs, all health care providers, including those that are named here, acupuncturists, audiologists, speech and language pathologists, chiropractors, dental hygienists, dentist, a nurse,
podiatrist,
dispensing optician, a podiatrist, and naturopath, optometrist, pharmacist, physical therapist or occupational therapist, all of these are licensed, physician or physician's assistant licensed, podiatrist, a psychologist, psychological associate, hospital, including a governmentally owned or operated hospital, employee, a health care provider acting within the course and scope of employment, an ambulatory surgical facility, other organizations, etc. So I can't think of any categories that we have left out of the definition.
Only mothers.
Yes. Well. Okay. So there is a lot, and it's under AS 0955 530 through 560. It's 560 definitions. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, one
question. Senator French.
Thank you. One question occurred to me recently, and that is, someone brought it to my attention, a practitioner in the field, an insurance defense attorney, not a plaintiff's attorney, mentioned that it was his belief that part of the problem with the number of insurance providers you have in the state is it's just a very small market. That if you look at our market compared to, say, Los Angeles, or San Francisco, Seattle, Chicago, you know, we're just a very, very tiny market. And so it occurred to me that if we're concerned about the shrinking number of insurance providers here in the state, that one piece of information that might help illuminate whether or not it's truly a problem or not would be to compare us with other like-sized markets, Montana, Wyoming,
North Dakota.
You know, are there 10 thriving insurance companies in those venues, or is there just one or two?
And I think that some of that is, Senator French, is very realistic. However, I think the primary concern that I've heard from the physicians' organizations is we only have two. They're both mutual companies, which basically, if their losses are lower, they get a dividend back in the form of reduced rates. If their losses are higher, they get a higher rate. And that the fear is if one of those pulls out of the state, the other company isn't going to pick up the physicians that it leaves behind. So the concern here is we've seen a shrinkage in the number of insurance companies. A couple of them have pulled out, said it's too risky, and we've only got two left. Now, whether more will come in or not, I don't know. If someone comes into the market as a mutual company, we may see the rise again of the old MICA system that'll apply just to the physicians in the state of Alaska. There are many different alternatives. But I'm sure that increased competition for the mutual companies is not necessarily going to cause a decrease in the premium, but the lower risk will have a comforting factor in being able to keep the companies that we have here and could affect the premium by reducing the risk overall. And we'll, of course, I intend to watch that very carefully. If we reduce the risk and insurance companies keep adding to the cost of the premium, you know, this cap may be shorter lived. I don't know. We'll have to look. We'll have to watch. Senator Terrio.
Chairman, just a question on the hedonic damages on page 2. The top of the page there says damages for non-economic losses shall be limited to, and it lists these things. It says but may not include hedonic damages.
I think some of those, the term hedonic, of course, is
it's defined down below.
Right.
Compensation for the pleasure of being alive. So since you've the cap is put on non-economic damages, but hedonic damages are separate.
I agree that it appears to be somewhat redundant.
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking. Has it been peeled out for a reason, and is there then a ban on it or a separate limit on it?
Good question. And we've thought of that before. I think you brought that up once before.
Well, I had asked about a definition once before and was pointed to that it was lower in the bill. But
Mr. Haugen, does anybody in your organization have any definition of what you would, or when you take a look at hedonic damages under definition, meaning damages that attempt to compensate for the pleasure of being alive, should that be other hedonic damages other than what could be included? That, if you want to come up to the front, it appears to me that, you know, pain, suffering, physical impairment, disfigurement, loss of enjoyment of life would be a hedonic, a loss of a consortium would be a hedonic damage under the definition.
I think it is a bit redundant, Senator. Loss of enjoyment of life and loss of pleasure of life was the definition. They're fairly similar, and I'm not sure quite what the distinction is.
So, as far as your organization is concerned, your intent is to try to limit damages to these things that are listed. So, would there be any objection if we put a period after damage rather than but may not include hedonic damages?
I don't think there'd be a problem with that, Senator. No.
Okay. Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, if you do that, then
we take away the definition as well. Or you want to use other hedonic damages, or you could leave it in there and say other.
Or the drafters chose to put this wording in.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's somewhat redundant, so I guess I'm fine with it in there.
Let's just take another brief at ease. We'll talk to the drafter, find out what the intent was there. Let's be off the record. Let's go back on the record. I have every indication to believe, Mr. Bullock, that you're with us. Is that correct? Okay. Mr. Bullock, this is Senator Seekins. Are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I am.
We have a question, and as we're taking a look at Senate Bill 67, the question is, in paragraph C on line 2, the phrase, but may not include hedonic damages. Question is, is this a redundant statement, or could you give us some assistance on this?
Well, one example of hedonic damages that I uncovered is in the case of a brain injury where the patient wouldn't feel pain any longer, so they wouldn't be subject to a recovery for pain or possibly suffering. And hedonic damages just says that life isn't what it used to be, and how do you value that? It's the quality of life issue rather than specific pain and suffering damages.
Okay.
So it's an additional type of damage.
So including loss of enjoyment of life.
The definition, Mr. Chair, that's in the bill is actually out of Black's Law Dictionary.
Okay.
And I haven't found any other reference other than it's just the pleasure of being alive. And in context, it's an additional type of damage to those that are already listed in subsection C of the new section, in section 2 of the bill.
All right, so we're just saying basically, or other damages which would be classified as hedonic damages.
Right.
Okay. And that's an accepted legal term.
Yes. So far as I've seen, it hasn't been pursued greatly, but at least 10 states I found a reference to it.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Bullock? Mr. Bullock, thank you very much for being with us this morning. We'll let you get back to work.
Thank you, sir. Bye.
Bye. Any other questions? Senator Terry, you got anything else to cause us to take a...
Wait a minute, but look, I'm looking at the fiscal notes, though.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder...
Senator French.
Thank you. I wonder if we couldn't take an approach that would sort of try to reach a happy medium. You could bring the level of damage awards down slowly, given that it isn't as if there's no insurance carriers in the state. There's two. And the concern is, well, if one leaves, then we're down to one. But, we meet every year. We can take these problems up. I just wonder if we couldn't, say, bring the current system and modify it slightly so as to give some measure of assurances to the industry and the practitioners that they're not going to continue to face huge awards, even though it seems as if you're... research has indicated that we rarely exceed the cap you're even proposing here. But I guess conceptually what I'm proposing is, say, taking the current caps, which I think are, 400 and a million, and, bring those down a little bit and see if that doesn't, if you can't sort of stair-step that level down so that you sort of reach a happy medium, if you will, so that injured people can recover for their damages that are inflicted by a careless doctor, and the industry and the doctors themselves can enjoy reasonably priced insurance and some modicum of protection, if you will, from baseless lawsuits.
I don't see a restriction on someone actually being able to recover for their actual damages. And in this case, we're just talking about the non-economic damages. I think this is the third year we've discussed this bill. If we could do that, we could do anything we want to. I'm willing to leave it where it is at the moment and go forward with it, but that's one of the things that all of us probably will discuss as it goes forward.
I guess just for the consideration of the committee, I'll throw out a conceptual amendment that would take the law as it stands right now, that's at 400,000 and a million, and say, what if we went down to 350,000 and 850,000? So you can get a $50,000 reduction in the most run-of-the-mill cases and a $150,000 reduction in the largest damages you could go after for non-pecuniary. Because as we've heard, you know, it's children and it's old people who are going to suffer the most under this bill, who can't demonstrate huge earning capacity, but who experience pain and loss of enjoyment of life just like anyone else would. And it strikes me that we can, you know, and next year, and if that works out, in a year or two, we can come back, and next year, you know, maybe stair-step it down a little bit more and try to find that sweet spot where you've got enough insurance carriers to provide, you know, a little bit of competition out there, and yet Alaska citizens can still get in front of a jury and say, hey, look, this terrible mistake, this putting, you know, cleaner fluid in me by an IV, you know, is caused me a huge damage.
So, Senator French, if you'd restate your conceptual amendment.
You would take the law as it stands right now, which has a cap of $400,000, and if you exceed that under extraordinary circumstances, $1 million, and simply reduce those two to $350,000 and $850,000. That's the
objection.
Mr. Chairman, I'll object. And I think, though, that the concern that's been expressed to me that the current system, that bifurcated system, you can really get around the lower number and always go to the top number. You're preserving, even though you're ratcheting them both down, you're preserving that structural problem. And so I don't know that just ratcheting those down, it doesn't do anything to fix that. That there should be a separation.
I agree.
If I may, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Senator French.
It certainly fixes it in as much as it lowers your total exposure by a significant amount. If the problem is that all cases go to the jury on the $1 million cap, then you've taken that down by 15%. That's got to produce some reduction in the total awards that are given. It's got to produce some happiness, if you will, in the insurance industry that they can no longer, you know, be sued for $1 million, that they're only looking at $850,000, and that seems like it acknowledges that there's a problem, and yet it preserves a fairly healthy recovery for the most egregious cases.
Is there further discussion on Senator Huggins?
I would prefer, as we have, to go ahead and make the leap, and as you said earlier, we can always adjust back upwards, but to incrementally inch our way along. I think we don't get the indicators that would be decisive for us to be able to make a decision in the future one way or the other. So let's just see what the effect is by doing something that will have an effect.
Okay. Further discussion? Senator Guest?
Yes, I had a question for Senator Tirio. I guess I hadn't had the conversations that the split cap isn't working. Can you maybe expound on why? I mean, it's easy to get around, but shouldn't we then deal with the easiness of it to get around versus not having the split cap for the severity? I mean, do we know why it's easy to get around? I was trying to find the statute.
If I could, maybe I could answer some of that.
We
gave you we did provide members with the one case from Bethel that basically, and I think the legislature does need to deal with the definition of severe, and as it applies to many other liabilities. And right now, because in fact in discussions with, I've found out that basically the reason that it is now, basically severe is defined as anything that can be embarrassing. So with that very easy hurdle to jump, you go outside of the current $400,000 cap to the $1 million category. I think our intent was to, at least on medical malpractice issues, claims against health providers, to put a hard cap in place and not have the current system that we have for other liabilities. And I do believe that we do need to address a definition in legislation for the word severe, because there was no definition for it in statute, the courts have defined it, and they've defined it very loosely. I think it's another issue, but it does affect this, but only if we were to roll back to a soft cap rather than a hard cap. Go ahead, Senator Guest.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Yeah, when I read the Bethel case, it had more to do with the jury making that decision on whether something was severe or not. But I would agree that it seems as if there's a problem with between the 400,000 and the million. It's in defining severe permanent physical impairment or severe disfigurement, and that may be the approach on to deal with those, so you don't take away that option. But I mean that's up to the committee to decide.
And you are correct. The jury, first of all, made the leap, but it was the Supreme Court that said
jury can.
The jury can and provided the definition. So it was a combination of the actions.
And I guess just to speak to the amendment in response to Senator Huggins, it is difficult to figure out the sweet spot, and you can say, well, we should go down here and see what happens. Well, we can see what happens with the insurance companies, but the trade-off is people that may get hurt in that meantime, and we can't go back and then change that later. And so I think there is some justification for doing this slowly instead of having the pendulum over here and then having it over here trying to find that middle, because we are talking about, you know, impacting people, not just the insurance agency. So I guess I would be speaking for the amendment.
Further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll, please.
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Huggins?
No.
Senator Terrio?
No.
Senator Guest?
Yes.
Chair Seekins?
No. Amendments failed. Are there further amendments? Seeing no further amendments or discussion, is there a will of the committee? Senator Huggins?
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate Bill, or committee substitute Senate Bill 67, be moved from committee with attached physical note and individual recommendations.
I'll object.
Objection has been made. Clerk, call the roll.
I could just speak briefly.
Oh, sure. Senator French, go ahead.
I think what the bill will likely do is lower rates a little bit, and what it will likely do is make a little more insurance available. I think that's likely. I'm not sure it's positive, but I think it's likely. But what I know it will do is it will deny recovery to the most seriously injured Alaskans, not the least serious. If you get a little owie on your wrist or an owie somewhere else by the negligence of a doctor, you'll be able to recover. But the most severely injured Alaskans are the ones who will absolutely be denied recovery under this bill. And that's why I object to it.
Other discussion? Clerk, please call the roll.
Senator Huggins?
Aye.
Senator Terrio?
Yes.
Senator Guest?
No.
Senator French?
No.
Yes. This bill's passed on to the next committee of referral. We'll take about a 3-minute recess, and we'll come back with Senator Guest's Bill 106. We're back on the record. Next on our agenda is Senate Bill 106, and I see the working draft that we have in front of us is a CS for Senate Bill number 106, identified in the upper right-hand corner as /India. Senator Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Gretchen Guest, State Senator from District J. My apologies for having another CS right in front of you. We have been working with both the Governor's Office and Representative Ramos and Crawford's office and trying to get everyone on the same page, and that led to another CS this morning. What I would like to do is just walk through.
Motion to adopt this CS, Senator?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the /I document be adopted as a working document before the committee.
Is there objection? Hearing none, we're working off I.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'd like to do is just walk through the section so I can both briefly explain them and also tell you the changes between the original bill and the CS you have in front of you. The intent of this bill and is basically to try to crack down on people that are buying Sudafed and other pharmaceutical products that are then cooking them down to meth without inhibiting legitimate uses. And so it's trying to strike that balance. You'll find in Section 1 of the bill, basically it's adding to the current controlled substance in a second degree both possession and delivery of basically the makings of meth. This CS does add the new Section 5, which was came from the governor's office. There's a slight difference between organic solution and non-organic solution, and that was basically the addition there. If you move to Section 2 on page 3, this section basically states that if you have in possession more than 9 grams, it's prima facie evidence that you're planning to make meth. In this section, the addition to this CS was just exempting if you had a valid prescription. So that's the difference between the original bill that you saw and the CS.
I'm sorry, what page?
Oh, page 3 at the top on Section 2. On Section 3 of the bill is basically just a cleanup provision. Section 4 of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question.
Yeah.
9 grams, can you give me an idea?
Yep, if I was going to ask this.
If you're buying the little blister packages, how many are you talking about?
Nine grams are basically about 375 pills, and approximately 7.2 grams is 300 pills, which would be 1 month's supply at the prescribed dosage. So it's a little bit more than 1 month's supply. And I'm going to, after I go through the bill, kind of talk about that specifically, because there is some disagreement between the stakeholder groups on how many grams should be in the legislation.
Senator French?
While we're on the gram question, a follow-up question is, how much meth can you make out of 9 grams of ephedrine or pseudoephedrine?
Well, that is a good question, Senator French. I'm going to have to find out and get back to you about on how much meth you can make.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
In Section 4, it discusses the purchase or the receipt. Again, it's back to 9 grams in that discussion. But in the CS, you'll just see ephedrine, pseudoephedrine, and then, if I get the pronunciation right, phenylpropanolefin. We call it PPA. But anyway, these all are chemicals that can be used to create meth. And that's why they were included in the CS.
Talking about number 3 there, phenylpropyl.
Phenylpropylamine. There you go. Referred to PPA, I would encourage the body to refer to it as that. That's what I do.
Yep. Question, Senator. Okay, go ahead.
And then Section 5 is about the dispensing and the ID check, et cetera. What was changed in this section was taking out the mandatory reporting that was in the previous bill, and also adding Section D, which was discussed on the House side, which is basically a local option, saying if a local municipality wants to have mandatory reporting in their local community, they can do that. And that's the changes there. I just wanted to go through the changes since I did put a new CS on your desk. And then next I'd like to, and then I'll answer some questions, talk a little bit about some of the issues that are still outstanding that you're going to probably hear in testimony. One is just the issue of what if the retailer sells to the wrong person? And how are we dealing with the criminal part of that? And you'll find that in Section 1, both on the delivers and the reckless disregard. And you'll see that also in Section 5, especially page 6, line 16. on checking the ID and keeping the log. I think it's important on balancing what the retailers and the small business, not putting so much of a burden on them when they're trying to sell a product and trying to find that balance of how much are we really going after the retailers versus just trying to prohibit people from buying too much of this product. So there's some good discussion around there. And that was one of the issues that the governor's office brought up to me. The second issue is what I refer to as the lodge example. What happens when a person wants to buy a case of Sudafed to take out to their lodge for the summer? And under this, under Section 2 of the bill, there wouldn't have to be any other evidence. They could actually, under that, that would be enough evidence that they could make meth. I think given just the nature of Alaska and some of the examples that we're going to actually ask the drafter to talk about 9 grams plus another indicator. So if you happen to have something else, if you happen just to have, you know, maybe 6 or 7 packets of Sudafed that are partially used in your house, and so you happen to run over the 9 grams, that's not evidence you're making meth. If you happen to buy a case of Sudafed to update your first aid kits if you're a tourist business or take it out to the lodge, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to make meth. I think the governor's office has a good concern that they brought up to me about some of these examples. And my thought, and if the committee wants to comment on it, is to kind of say there's the grams and one other indicator kind of make other prima facie evidence instead of just the grams. There will be the discussion. DPS will be online tomorrow. Sergeant Burt had the day off, and I didn't think it was that he could be here tomorrow instead of pulling him in on his day off over Easter weekend. DPS will testify, and I haven't heard their testimony, that they would rather have 6 grams. The federal law and most states are 9 grams. 7.2 grams is a one-month supply. So you're going to hear some testimony, and I think it really is up to this committee on where we sit on what we think the grams should be. But I'm interested in knowing why DPS really wants 6 versus 7.2 or 9, and they're going to provide us that testimony tomorrow. But there will be some discussion around that. There's an issue with the service counter and having all of this behind the service counter. These are about 300 products that have some of the chemicals in here. We are going to work with the drafter. There seems to be an amendment actually coming out of Washington to say if it's a sole entity, which means it's not combined with anything else, it's basically pure ephedrine, put that behind the counter, and the combination products basically punt to the Board of Pharmacy for them to decide. So then DPS and the Board of Pharmacy can have a discussion about other combination products which are becoming a problem, but we're not putting 300 products, Alka-Seltzer, et cetera, behind a counter. So you're going to see probably that discussion this week from the pharmacists when they testify. We're also trying to work on some language that gets at what we want, but doesn't make it so we have to come back and open up the statute every year. One of the problems with illegal labs is people get very creative. So one drug that's used 1 year, now if they can't get that, they figure out how to cook down a liquid, and then they figure out how to cook down a combination. And finally, the other issue that's been brought to my attention that I wanted to bring to the committees is keeping the logbook. Some of the pharmacy groups don't necessarily want to keep the logbook. DPS has told me that it's important for them to keep the logbook. So that's another issue, I think, for the committee to consider. And with that, I'll answer any questions. I'll just tell you that tomorrow DPS will be online, and on Thursday, Dean Guarnelli will be online. Unfortunately, Dean wasn't available today or tomorrow, and DPS wasn't available until tomorrow. And with that, Ms. Chair, I'll answer any questions that the committee has.
Senator Terrio.
On page 5, middle of the page, there, starting on line 13, where you talk about may not dispense substance unless the retailer confirms a person's identity. Have you had any conversations with public safety about the availability of government-issued IDs in remote areas of the state? And in fact, you know, do the people in those communities routinely have government-issued IDs? I don't know, really.
Through the chair, in response to Senator Terrio, I have not. I will research that. We try to use as broad as possible, so that could be any form: military, passport, state ID, driver's license, from another state, kind of, any government issued. But it's a good question. I'll make sure that I check into it and get back to you.
Senator French.
On that point. And what about mail order? If you live in the bush and want to buy Costco Sudafed, it sounds like that would be impossible under this bill, or at least under this show an ID provision. I don't even know this. I mean, I don't know if people buy it by mail, but if you live in McGrath or even out of McGrath, and, you know, it may just be 10 times cheaper to buy a case from Costco.
That's a good question. I have an affinity against putting retailers at jeopardy. I'll tell you that going in. Having been in the retail business for my entire professional career, I kind of get real nervous when new regulations and laws come down that require me to sign and get another waiver, have another disclosure form, have another this, have another that. And if one of my lower paid people just doesn't feel like doing what they're being paid to do, I'm at jeopardy. And I have 120 employees. I'll bet you that I have 12 of them today that are doing something I'm not paying them to do. At least 12. And so I have a natural affinity to putting an owner of a business in jeopardy based on the negligence of someone who is an employee and has no jeopardy themselves. I mean, they can cause me to suffer harm, but they say, tough luck, see you later. So I have a question from a retailer standpoint there, what kind of jeopardy we're putting these people in. And I would like to see some demonstration from somewhere that this process has led to some kind of successful interdiction or prosecution of people, rather than just being another meaningless, feel-good piece of paper that we're putting out there that has no value. I'd kind of like to see that. Go ahead, Senator French.
On that point, and I think that's why we're here working on this, is that
the
Oklahoma experience has been that, you know, if you restrict the sales of these materials, you can really get a grip on your meth problem. And I think it's particularly attractive for this state, where you can't just hop in a car and drive somewhere, you know, an hour and find a new market. You know, if you're in Fairbanks and you can't get enough Sudafed to make meth, you're done. You're gonna move on to a different product or not do it. Wasilla, my community, Anchorage, same problem. I mean, it's a really attractive idea because of the ubiquitousness of this ephedrine, and you know the centrality of it to the production of meth. So I agree, and I'm very concerned about making lawful users, housewives, tour boat operators, you know, guiding companies, all, you know, they can have all tons of this stuff if they want to, but what you want to keep it away from are guys that are driving around in beater cars, going back to their beater apartments and the houses and cooking up meth. And so I think there's a way to do it, and I appreciate the effort Senator Guest is making, and I appreciate your concern as well.
And I do share that concern too. I would tell you, I've been married to a hoarder for 35 years. You could probably find 375 products in my house, partially opened, put back in this drawer or in this packet, and meaning to take this to this cabin and still sitting there. For that to be then prima facie evidence that she's going to be a manufacturer, I get a little nervous about that. And so we do need that or something else in there. And prima facie says, yeah, it's a good story and you don't have no defense. I mean, we don't even consider your defense. It's just there. You can't even...
You can rebut it. I mean, it's enough to get started.
But prima facie doesn't require a rebuttal.
But it can be rebutted.
Yeah, it can be rebutted. So all of a sudden, it's prima facie, you're under arrest. Where do we put that housewife who is a hoarder? I'm going to have to go through my house and search to make sure my wife has none stashed around the house. So, you know, I guess that's kind of, you know, so where are we from an accidental situation where we hit that threshold? And I know you're addressing that, but, you know, what brings someone to the point where they can search my home? Are they still going to have to meet that high probable cause level before they can search my home to count the number of Sudafrin products I have in my home? I realize this is a very insidious product, and we need to control it, and we need to put those people behind bars where we can that are manufacturing it, selling it, putting other people at risk. I just don't want to put folks in behind bars that are not in that industry, but are innocent, accidental, or whatever, accidental criminals. You know, okay, so I appreciate that we could work on that, because mm-hmm. I do have some problem with that. Also, Senator Theriault.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I had seen the article here in our packet here about the Oklahoma law. I had the same question. And I'm just wondering if Senator Guest has had conversations with folks in Oklahoma. It says enacted last April, so it's just about a year old. They say there's an 80% drop-off, but I'm wondering if you've heard problems from... the pharmacies that they've run into, and you know, so we've not only heard the good from the outcome of their passage of the law, but also what problems mm-hmm. Should we anticipate coming up?
Through the chair, Senator Theriault.
Yes.
We have talked to the chair of the pharmacy group, or I have, and they have, no one's brought the pharmacy industry or those in Alaska haven't brought any problems from Oklahoma in our conversations with Oklahoma. They haven't stated any, but we also haven't asked that specific question. So let me make sure and kind of go back to Oklahoma and ask the people we've been working with there that specific question, make sure we haven't overlooked anything. There were no suggestions that they had for problems that they had with their bills. And oftentimes, you know, when we've gone to other states, when I worked on the meth lab cleanup bill, we were able to go to the other states and they were able to tell us this worked, this didn't work. We haven't gotten that from the model legislation, but I will go back and double check and make sure on the retailer side.
Would be interesting to find out on just a test case basis whether or not you could go online and have Sudafedrin sent to you through some of the other online sources.
Chair, I believe you can. And in this, they would have to, you know, keep the log and do the ID and do all the same things that they had to do now.
We do have a couple of people that wanted to testify, and we're going to hear them, and then we'll carry the bill over. So let's go first to the Barrow LIO, and I have Paul Carr on from the North Slope Borough Police Department. Are you with us, Paul?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
If you would put yourself on the record, sir, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Paul Carr. I'm the police chief for the North Slope Borough. And I speak in support of Senate Bill 106. Here in Barrow, dramatic increase in crime associated with meth use, burglaries, assaults, robberies, things along those lines. And through the course of our investigations, what we're hearing is that people in town are making meth. And from what's being described to us, it's the Sudafed reduction method that they're using. So anything we can do as a state to make it more difficult for people to buy Sudafed or to get enough Sudafed to make a batch of methamphetamine, I think would be a positive step. And so I just wanted to speak in support of the general concept. I understand there's a lot of concerns about the details, and I'm not particularly concerned about that as much as I am the general idea that we need to limit availability of Sudafed.
Okay. I do appreciate that, Paul. If there's other questions for Paul? Senator French?
Just one. Chief Carr, are you making busts of labs there, or is it just you're seeing increases in possession and the associated problems with that?
We've not actually busted a lab yet, but what we are hearing from people is that it is being made locally. And again, when they describe to us the method, what we're hearing is basically the Sudafed reduction method.
Thank you.
Other questions? Hearing none, thank you very much, Mr. Carr, for your testimony today. Let's move to the Fairbanks LIO. We have Paul Holland listed there. Paul, are you with us this morning?
Yes.
If you'll put yourself on the record, sir, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning, too.
Yeah, Paul Holland in Fairbanks. I'm testifying in support of the direction of this bill. I've personally been affected by meth users. There was a meth lab that was busted on my road early winter. Been talking to neighbors. Two of them had been burglared over the summer, over the winter. We've been watching. There's two lots, one where they cooked on and one a guy had been living on. It turned out he had been squatting and then he took off and they've dropped off. There's still the kind of traffic. These are 5-acre lots and they're kind of rural. There's been three rigs that have been dropped off over the winter that we've reported and they were stolen, and I guess they'd drop them off and then later would pick them up. It is a big problem. I saw in the news minor on the first of the year reported that the courts were more busy here than they had ever had been, and they said they didn't know why, and I'm afraid I have a strong feeling that it was because of meth. I know other states report studies on inmates, and up to 80% are meth users. The jailbreak here at the, I believe it's a state jail. They got a front-end loader and they ran through the fence and tried to just crash into the building, and they just happened to hit the building at a real strong support deal, and it thwarted them, but that was $800,000, and that was meth people. It's a problem. It's an enormous cost, I think we're a little bit slow in realizing the extent of the problem. Other states are further into realizing the extent of the problem. And the one effective way I think that's been shown to reduce the meth labs, not just to call it Sudafed, but basically the drugs that are necessary, if we can knock that out of their hands, they basically cannot produce it. I would say it's a very small, if any, increase to the public. It is here locally. You know, it's a real inconvenience when very little of it goes to meth use, but many medicines are under prescription only status, and that's what allows Sudafed to still be available. I have to get a prescription to get allergy medicine come summertime.
Sir, hey Paul.
Yes.
Are you rubbing something up against that microphone, or are we getting that from somewhere else?
I'm clicking a pen here, so I'll see if I can.
That wouldn't have been it, but we're getting feedback from somewhere. So, okay, go ahead.
Try again. Just in terms of the potential hassle to the public, I've got to get an allergy or prescription for allergy medicine for birch pollen. There's a lot of drugs and medicines under prescription. I just don't think that the slight inconvenience is, if someone's aware of the problem and the cost, it's a necessary thing to restrict this. I just think we're responding to a new and growing problem, and we need to act sooner rather than later. And in terms of the particulars of this bill, I would be more for the 6 grand side and also the mandatory reporting, because I can see how they could, you know, go from store to store and each store records a name, sure, but I know in Fairbanks there's probably dozen places you could get the 6 or 9 grams. But I thank you for the effort on this, and I hope to see this passed this session.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Holland?
Mr. Holland, are you representing yourself?
Yes. I would like to. There's no organization in Alaska that I know against meth. There is some national stuff. I've been in a neighbor. Neighbors have spent, you know, looking on the web and stuff, but there's no organization. If there is, I would like to be part of it, just against this meth.
Okay, thank you. Senator Terrio.
And whereabouts do you live in Fairbanks?
Farmers Loop. They're by Dog Mushers.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Holland. Appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
Let's go to the off-nets, and Barry Christensen from the Alaska Farmer says he's there to answer questions. But, Barry, I'd like to ask you a question, if you'd come on and just tell us your interest in the bill.
Sure thing. Yeah, this is Barry Christensen. I'm the chair of the legislative committee for the Alaska Pharmacists Association, so we represent the pharmacists and pharmacies in Alaska. We do appreciate Senator Guest asking our input. In fact, we spoke with her on the phone on Friday before we actually saw the substitute language here. We are supported, the association is supported in trying to limit the spread of the problems we have with methamphetamine in the state. We do have some problems with the recording aspects. And basically it boils down to pharmacists are really busy, and to put a whole bunch of new products in the back of our shelves is going to be burdensome time-wise for us. But we're willing to work with the legislature on this and hopefully get a good bill through.
Any questions for Mr. Christensen? Senator Terrio.
So Senator Guest mentioned trying to have some leeway written into the bill so that you would work with the pharmacy board. Would that be your preferred route?
It would be for what we call the multi-ingredient products. I'll give you an example. In our store here in Ketchikan, at the community pharmacy in Ketchikan, we've actually limited the single entity Sudafed products in our store for a couple of years because we saw the problem. So for the last couple of years, we haven't sold any pseudoephedrine without the customer coming up and asking us. And that has greatly limited the amount of product we've sold. We still have over-the-counter combination products, and virtually those products are not being bought for illicit use. So that's one of the association's concerns, is that we have a lot of combination products out there that probably they're not going to want because they're basically hard to cook down. And will they go and do it? Well, maybe so. But that's what we talked to Senator Guest about on Friday was if those things do come up, to have the Board of Pharmacy with the Department of Safety bring those to our attention, and those could also be brought back behind the cabinet.
Sir, Senator French.
Thank you. Could you just, for those of us who aren't as familiar with this, give me an example of what a combination product is?
Sure. Maybe like Tylenol Cold, which has Tylenol in it along with the decongestant Sudafed, or Comtrex, which is a combination that has something for a cough and something for the decongestant and Tylenol for the aches and pains.
Thank you.
Other questions for Senator Huggins?
Mr. Christensen, Senator Huggins here. Reference other sources to get the same items we're talking about. How difficult do you see it for people going outside the state, no matter what the methodology is, to obtain the same sort of items?
That's a good question, Senator. It all depends on the state. And, we as an association actually prefer to see a federal law so everybody be on the same page with this, because every state seems to be doing something a little bit different. Some states have gone to the extreme of Oklahoma has, and those just for information, that state, that's a pharmacy-only purchase of pseudoephedrine in those states. Our association doesn't necessarily endorse that because of our state. We're geographically, we're such a large state, and that we don't think that would be practical for our patients that we serve. There are other states that don't have any, like Alaska currently doesn't have anything in the books regarding how much you can purchase. There are states that have adapted voluntary, like my story with them, where they just brought the product back behind the shelf, and those states have shown a decrease in the amount of benefiting labs that are being clear their crop on that. But the benefiting problem is still huge. And from what we've been told, a lot of it has to do with it being, apparently Mexico is a prime place to bring over the already made product. So you can still get it online. I did a search a couple of weeks ago. You can still get it online and have it shipped to you. I tried to order, I think I ordered a dozen bottles of 60 milligram Sudafed online. It was expensive. It was four or five times as much as the retail markup in our store. But you can get it online.
Thank you very much.
Other questions for Mr. Christensen? Mr. Christensen, we appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you very much. We can be sure to contact us if we can help you out.
You bet. We will do that, sir. Thank you. Are there further questions? Anyone else in the audience that wanted to testify today? I didn't see anyone. I don't see anyone else online. So we're going to go ahead and hold this bill over. Let's see, Wednesday, we start at 8:30. We will only go till 9:30 because Senator Lisa Murkowski will be here using this room, and so we'll only be for an hour. We'll continue on if you have your people lined up on Senate Bill 106, Senator Guest. If we get some time, we'll look at 117, Senator French.
Tomorrow.
And we will carry over whatever we don't get into on those two on Thursday. Thursday's heavy. It may be difficult to squeeze in anything else in there, but we will work on that. We're going to, at this point, we're canceling. We earlier had a scheduled confirmation hearing on Herman Walker Jr., and we're canceling that. He is not available, and I don't think we will hear him as we go forward. Thursday, we'll try to squeeze as much as we can in here, and we'll just keep working on these bills here as we go forward. So we'll just have to kind of play it by ear, but I like our format of being able to go Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and try to hit these bills continuously without having to worry about our running out of time. So with that, we're going to adjourn the Judiciary Committee for the day.